On this edition of Blue Dot, we talk with one of the brightest young stars in astronomy and astrophysics, Vikram Ravi. He's a Millikan Fellow at the California Institute of Technology, and he's investigating some of the most mysterious and awesome forces in the universe, enigmatic fast radio bursts emanating from beyond our Milky Way. We'll talk about his work and career. It's all new and all blue next. Nolan, our guest this week, has a fascinating background. He's of Indian origin, but he was raised and educated in Australia. His parents were also astronomers, and he's worked on some of the world's most prestigious astronomical instruments.
Like what?
Oh, like the giant Parkes radio telescope that was made famous in the movie The Dish in Australia, and the 200-inch Palomar telescope in Southern California. Vikram Ravi, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Great. I'd like to start by getting a sense of your upbringing, because it's pretty unique. Could you tell us a bit about your parents and how you came to be raised in Australia?
Well, my parents, as you've said, are also astronomers like myself. They met doing their PhDs in India and have since worked in a few different countries around the world, including Australia, of course, and Germany and the United States. We moved to Australia in 1998, and this was to a telescope called the Australia Telescope Compact Array in northern New South Wales, about 300 miles northwest of Sydney. And, yeah, we lived on site for 8 years. I went through high school while living there.
When did you first know you wanted to be an astronomer like your parents?
Well, there's two parts to that. The first is that I guess I when I went to university, I enrolled in a physics degree at the Australian National University, and I sort of had no particular interest in astronomy at the time. I was doing things like working on Bose-Einstein condensates, working on climate modeling and similar things. And I guess when I got to my fourth year project, I realized that the thing that I was most interested in and the thing that seemed sort of able to teach me the most would be an astronomy project. And so that is what I did and haven't really looked back since. I guess the astronomy I do, while I also use radio waves, like my parents do, quite different, I would say, to what my parents do. At least I'd hope so, anyway.
What was the first project you got involved with?
Right, so the first project I was involved with was a study of radio emission from nearby stars. And so stars come in various shapes and sizes. Some are very big, much bigger than the sun, and some are very small. Some stars, especially the big ones, start up with very large magnetic fields, and we don't really understand how these fields are created and how they evolve as the stars evolve and eventually explode in supernovae. And so this particular study was a study of stellar magnetic fields using the radio emission from stars. These stars are basically like big bar magnets rotating in space, which makes them a generator. And if you've got a generator, you're accelerating charged particles and radiating primarily in radio waves in this case. And that is how we studied these magnetic fields.
Now, as I mentioned, you've worked on some of the world's most prestigious and famous astronomical instruments. I'd like to hear about some of your experiences at those places, especially Parkes, because you know that telescope was made famous by one of my favorite movies.
I guess you mean The Dish.
The Dish, yes, which is the story of how Parkes was used as one of the receivers for getting the television signals from Apollo 11. And that movie starred Patrick Warburton and Sam Neill, and it's just one of my favorite films. Highly recommended.
Yeah, so would I. So Parkes, of course, is quite a venerable instrument, and it is a 64-meter diameter radio dish sitting in Australia. And I guess I've been using Parkes since 2007, really, for research. And, yeah, until about 2013, you were able to actually go and observe from there. So Parkes, for those of you who haven't seen a picture of it, is basically this dish on top of a tower. And the astronomers sit in the tower underneath this really, really big dish. And so it is definitely in your interest to obey things like wind safety warnings. You do not want the dish falling over on top of you. I guess one of the nicer stories I've heard about Parkes, and that kind of reflects the spirit of the people who built it, was that Parkes, around the time that the moon landings were going on, another big thing that Parkes did was to establish the position of sources called quasars. We think that these are supermassive black holes sitting in the hearts of very distant galaxies. And as gas falls onto the black holes, the gas is heated up, magnetic field is generated, and you get these immensely powerful jets of radiation and material propagating out of the black holes. And that causes them, if the jets are pointed towards us, to shine very brightly. These, we think, are quasars. And so Parkes, in the late 60s, was used to identify the positions of quasars by figuring out very accurately when they disappeared behind the moon. This is called lunar occultation. And so if you know exactly when they disappear behind the moon, you know where the moon is in the sky, you get a sense of what the position of the quasar is. And so Parkes was used to find the position of the first quasar confirmed to be outside our galaxy by astronomers here at Caltech, as it turns out, at Palomar Observatory. But this quasar was a bit too far north for Parkes. It was called 3C273, and the Parkes telescope couldn't actually see it. What they had to do, in fact, was cut a few meters of material off the edge of the dish and drive it sort of a little bit beyond the various limits in order to get this quasar. Story goes that they had sort of people standing by with pikes ready to manually turn the dish if anything failed, because they had to get it right just in the very time that thing went behind the moon, which, of course, happens quite rarely. They had to get that right. And they did. They, by cutting the edge of the dish, they were able to get the position of the first quasar, which enabled astronomers at Palomar Observatory to measure its distance.
Wow, that's fascinating. Let's talk about your more recent work now. You are involved with studying something called fast radio bursts, right?
Yes.
And could you explain to us what those are?
Sure. So fast radio bursts, or FRBs, or Furbies, however you like to call them.
Furbies is kind of cool.
Some people call them that. Fast radio bursts are these really incredibly puzzling and intriguing flashes of radio waves from outside our galaxy. They last only about a millisecond, and when they're on, they're among the brightest sources of radio waves in the sky. So we know of many things within our galaxy that emit flashes, millisecond flashes of radio waves. These things are called pulsars, which are sort of the neutron star remnants, the collapsed remnants of massive stellar supernovae that rotate very fast. And again, like the magnetic field example I talked about before, basically like big bar magnets rotating in space, they act as generators and accelerate charges, radiate radio waves, and they have these beams of radio waves that every time the pulsar sweeps by the Earth, you see a little pulse. And so we know that they produce bursts of radio waves in millisecond timescales because every pulse of a pulsar is different. However, the key thing about FRBs, fast radio bursts, that makes them unique is that they are what is called dispersed. So the light is delayed at different frequencies by different amounts, and the delay is due to the material between us and the burst. And whereas pulsars have sort of the amount of material between us and them that you expect from our galaxy, fast radio bursts have so much more. Up to 20 times more material than you expect within our galaxy, which tells us that they are beyond our galaxy.
So they're really far away.
They're really far away, exactly.
What are some ideas about the origins of these mysterious bursts?
Well, there are definitely more published theories about these bursts than there are published bursts at the moment. And there are 18 published bursts right now. I guess some ideas range from things as, I guess, astrophysically mundane as a really big pulsar, a really big neutron star, a really powerfully emitting neutron star in galaxies quite far away, but not incredibly far away. So we're talking maybe 300 million light years, maybe a billion light years. That's far, but not incredibly far as scales of the universe go. Those ideas are probably among the more accepted possibilities. However, other ideas include things such as two neutron stars colliding with each other and forming this object which, within milliseconds, collapses to form a black hole. And when it collapses, all the magnetic fields hosted by the object kind of snap at the event horizon of the black hole and dissipate as a fast radio burst, at least so the theory goes. There are also theories involving cosmic strings, but then many things can be explained using cosmic strings.
What are cosmic strings?
Well, I'm not sure that anyone really knows. Cosmic strings are thought to be a way of linking the different forces of nature. So we're talking electromagnetic forces, gravitational forces, and strong and weak nuclear forces. And it's thought to be a way of linking these different forces and explaining various aspects of cosmology.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio, and we're talking to astrophysicist and astronomer Vikram Ravi from Caltech. Following up on what you were just talking about, last year we had the first detection of gravitational waves, which was announced from LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. Has that given us any insights into these Furbies that we've been talking about, the fast radio bursts? Might that be a way of studying these objects?
Well, to an extent. So people have set limits on the gravitational waves on the gravitational waves that could have existed at the time that these bursts went off. However, these limits so far are not particularly constraining on specific models. However, as we start to detect more bursts, and especially as we start to detect them coincident with when LIGO, or rather advanced LIGO, operates, we'll certainly start setting better limits. And for example, the models where you have two neutron stars colliding and producing a fast radio burst, those will be very tightly constrained by gravitational wave observations.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with astrophysicist Vikram Ravi from Caltech. And we're back talking with astronomer Vikram Ravi from Caltech. You know, you were just talking about something. I'm trying to visualize that because if you imagine, could you explain to our listeners what two neutron stars colliding would actually be like? Because you're talking about two of the most dense and compact and energetic objects in the universe. Can you describe to us what that would be like?
Well, I guess the first part of it is that neutron stars are, yes, of course, among the most dense, compact objects.
For example, if I had a teaspoonful of neutron star, give us a sense of what the mass of that would be.
Well, it's about one ton.
Wow.
And so neutron stars are extremely dense. They're extremely dense because when you've got sort of just your typical atoms with a nucleus and electrons sort of whizzing around the nucleus, neutron stars have that those atoms basically all scrunched up into just one big massive nucleus. So a single neutron star is thought to be something like 10 miles across, and yet it weighs more than the mass of the Sun. All neutron stars weigh at least 1.4 times the mass of the Sun. And so when two of these things collide, you, of course, have a huge amount of energy being released. We think that the energy is mainly released in gamma rays, and so we really wouldn't want one of these to go off very near to the Earth. However, there's also a lot of energy released in gravitational waves, which you would certainly sense with a gravitational wave detector, but you would find very hard to sense just with your ears, for example. Other things that you expect to see are is sort of a flash of optical light, sort of just normal visible light, as matter falls onto the newly formed neutron star. And this flash might last, the theories range from minutes to days. The theories are quite uncertain on this point. Otherwise, the thing that sort of interests me as someone who studies fast radio bursts the most is that when two of these neutron stars collide, you could either end up with a new neutron star that's, of course, more massive than the original two, or you could end up with a black hole. And the dividing line between these two cases is whether or not the neutron star can support itself. So it's whether or not it can support itself against the immense gravitational forces causing it to collapse. And that is something that we're all trying to figure out, which neutron stars create black holes and which ones don't, because that's thought to be one of the main ways of producing really massive neutron stars and the lowest mass black holes that we know of.
To give our listeners a sense of how powerful a gravitational field that would be, if you were to take a person and put them on the surface of a neutron star, what would happen to them?
Well, the neutron star itself is basically just made up of neutrons. All the electrons and protons have been the electrostatic forces that cause them to orbit each other are kind of overcome by gravity, and the electrons and protons just fuse to form neutrons. The same would happen to us. We would be compressed is the right word.
Squished into neutronic goo.
Exactly, yeah. And we would not be able to see the size of the object we would become. It would be too small.
Why do you personally find studying these mysterious objects so interesting?
Well, I guess probably one of the main interests for me in astrophysics is that it really does seem incredible that using physics that we've basically come up with here on Earth and supported mainly by lab experiments we do on the Earth, we were able to come up with these really awesome models for things that we see throughout the universe. I mean, ultimately, we're just sitting here on the Earth observing radiation, light, for example, that travels across billions of light years. We have no way of ever going there and actually, you know, sending a probe out to a neutron star and understanding the magnetic fields around it and understanding the structure of the star and so on. And yet we're able to come up with incredible models that allow us to predict what these things will do in the future. And whether or not these models are exactly right, we don't know, but it really does amaze me that we're able to, in some sense, understand what's going on so far away just on the basis of extrapolating from what we know on Earth. I find that quite amazing.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. We're talking to astrophysicist Vikram Ravi from Caltech. And I'd like to ask you, what are some common misconceptions that people have about the kind of work modern astronomers like you do?
Well, I guess the classic picture of an astronomer is someone who spends a lot of time looking at the stars, trying to figure out what certain stars are doing at certain times of the year, maybe using a telescope, a nice brass-looking thing to look up the stars as well, trying to map out constellations. The probably the most common misconception I've had is that I know a lot about astrology, which I don't. And so I guess what astronomers really do on a day-to-day basis, it actually does vary quite widely among the astronomical community. Some astronomers are theorists, and so they spend a lot of time in front of whiteboards, blackboards if you've got one, and computers doing simulations and solving equations. Astronomers that tend to use telescopes a bit more will actually spend a lot of time traveling to these telescopes, which are in far-flung places like Hawaii, Chile, the Canary Islands. There are also telescopes in very, very remote parts of the world, like Western Australia and the desert in South Africa. And so astronomers that use telescopes tend to travel quite a bit to these places. But I guess the biggest misconception about astronomers is that our work days are somehow different to many others. And unfortunately, the answer is often no. We spend a lot of time in front of computers, and we spend a lot of time moving data around and programming and taking care of databases and things like that. But I guess we do it because we hope to discover things.
So when you're at a party and somebody asks you what you do and you say, I'm an astronomer, you kind of probably have to disabuse them of some romantic notions that you're out.
Well, only to the extent that's needed at the time. We like to maintain some of the mystery as well.
Well, there you go. And of course they have to, you know, ask you what your sign is, and then you got to go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You've studied and worked in Australia and California now. What can you tell us about what it's like working in different institutions in places like Australia compared to California, especially Caltech, which is, you know, the premier science institution on the West Coast, and also the real life setting for the fictional characters in TV's The Big Bang Theory?
Well, I think that each institution, of course, has its own character. But given that so many people and so many institutions around the world tend to have come there from somewhere else, for example, in the group of people that I work with at Caltech, we've got people from, let's see now, Russia, Bulgaria, India, Norway, Spain, China, Japan, and Korea. And so in addition, of course, to people from the United States and Canada. And so it's quite a cosmopolitan environment, astronomy. This may not be entirely true in other fields, but I wouldn't be quite sure about that. But I guess the institutional and cultural differences between places, in my experience anyway, have been kind of washed out by the fact that so many people that you work with have already lived in and worked in so many different places in the world. Caltech in particular, I was very pleasantly surprised by how inclusive and friendly I found the work environment. Astronomy is different from, I guess, the fields primarily portrayed in the Big Bang Theory, in that we don't work in labs, we're able to work from home as well, because ultimately a lot of the stuff we do just requires an internet connection. For example, I can control the Parkes telescope using just an internet connection on my laptop. I don't think that Caltech, I mean, for all its reputation as a place of lots of hard work and not much else, I didn't find that to be true.
When it comes to what else, what are some things you like to do when you're not doing astronomy for fun?
Well, I play the keyboard and the oud, which is a Middle Eastern stringed instrument. What else do I do? I play soccer. I like to read and travel and various things like that. I like to eat many different things as well.
Don't we all, especially this time of year? And so you're a musician?
A little bit. Not for a while,
just
but I do enjoy.
Dabble. Okay.
Yeah.
What are some of the projects you're going to be working on, you know, in the coming new year? What are you working on now?
Well, I guess the one project that I'm spending most of my time on now is related to fast radio bursts, in that we are trying to build a telescope at Caltech's Owens Valley Radio Observatory. It's up near Bishop in Eastern California. And we're trying to build a telescope that will try to that will pinpoint exactly where in the sky FRB's fast radio bursts come from. So at the moment, when we detect these things, we can kind of localize them to areas that are roughly about a quarter of the size of the full moon. So that's an incredibly large area in the sky within which you have many stars, many galaxies, many clusters of galaxies even, and so it's quite hard to know exactly which galaxy or which object in the sky the fast radio burst came from. However, we're trying to build a telescope that will pinpoint the locations of fast radio bursts to individual galaxies, if indeed they originate from galaxies. And so that will consist of just 10 radio dishes that, in fact, arrived just yesterday in a bunch of boxes in a shipping container. And so we're hoping to have them all together by the end of February, and we expect to be able to localize a fast radio burst at least, if not better, than once a month. And so that, we hope, will really provide a breakthrough in this field.
If you could get the answer to one fundamental question you have about the universe, what would that be?
How much more is there than we know of at the moment? So at the moment, we think that we pretty much understand how the universe evolves. We think that it sort of evolved through an era where it's very hot, and then as it cooled, different components of it kind of started to evolve separately, and so you started to have dark matter evolving, and then normal matter evolved in sort of this framework of dark matter, and the whole thing was eventually dominated by what we think of as dark energy. And so we think we've kind of got these components. We don't know what dark matter is, we don't know what dark energy is, but we think we kind of have a broad sense of how they fit in the universe as a whole. And so to me, what I would really like to know is whether this particular model of the universe that we have, astronomers call it the lambda CDM model, or lambda being dark energy, CDM being cold dark matter. I'd really like to know whether this model is it. Is this the model that is this the best model we can ever make for the universe as a whole? Because to me, it would be completely remarkable if this were the case. Throughout history, I think astronomers have gone from very simplistic models of the universe to what we think of today as very complicated models. But it would be absolutely amazing if our model today was it. And I would really like to know whether it is. I guess one possibility that may be there to extend what we know would be if we're just living in a bubble. Like, if our universe or our perception of the universe is just one way of looking at it, and if we were in some other part of the universe, would we see the same universe or a different universe? It's not entirely clear. That is something that would be very nice to know.
Our guest has been astronomer Vikram Ravi from the California Institute of Technology. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can listen to this and past episodes on mynspr.org. Follow us on Twitter at NSPRNews or me at Dave Shlom. Epic thanks go to the man in the low castle, Nolan Ford, for making this all sound quite professional. He and I remind you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.